Welcome, 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 everyone, Trek fans, or Story Trek fans, I should say, to our ninth episode of our podcast. I am, of course, your co-host, Michael Stridigakis.
And I'm Marshall Hopkins.
And today, we are venturing away from the hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of hours of television and stepping into the mere mortal, you know, less than 30 hours of cinema of the Star Trek universe. So we're talking about a much smaller, sizable base of film. Potentially at the same time, one of the most influential parts of the Star Trek universe.
Totally agreed. There was a period of time from the late 70s up until 1987 that you don't really get Star Trek anyplace else. So these movies carried the franchise. And I think that that's significant to talk about, but also in terms of carrying the story forward, you know, there are so many things from the movies that actually stretch out into the TV series that influence the TV series beyond just the look of the Klingons. I think that, you can't really discuss Story Trek without talking about the movies pretty significantly. And I think that we kind of want to take an approach as to what works and what didn't work, why they worked and why they didn't work.
The movies actually have carried the franchise more than once, actually twice. You have, of course, the first in 1979 with the release of the motion picture. And then again, you had in 2009 with the release of the Star Trek film. And both times, there was no other Star Trek. So in retrospect, those periods are very touchstone and very key to the viability of the Star Trek franchise and universe as a whole. And we are going to touch a little bit upon the details of each of these movies to a certain extent, but really kind of looking at things from a larger grouping. For instance, you have a run of films from 1979 to 1991, which featured the original series cast. And then we transition in 1994 to 2002 with the TNG cast. And then, of course, we have the 2009 to, I'm going to cautiously say the present,
right,
of Star Trek. So there are three different eras of the Star Trek films, and they've changed the way that they've executed their films significantly from each one. So that's what we wanted to talk about narratively.
And I have to admit, I wish that we could have even longer to talk about. There's so many different touchstones on the three different eras. You could do an entire episode about how each different era represents the future in terms of the set design, the prop design, the costume design.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely true. I mean, the art design of Star Trek, I mean, when you really look at it, when just to touch on that for a second, 1979, they were still filming everything with like models and forced perspective and, rudimentary lasers and crude motion control cameras and all, everything miniature that they could, stop motion. And then you get to the 90s Star Trek, and by that point it had evolved visual effects-wise to practically, they had gone into this era of everything is CG, and we're going to film everything with a computer, and everything is going to be digital. And then you get to the 2009 era of Trek, and now even in Star Trek Beyond, the camera is filming electronically. It's not even a film camera anymore for the first time in Star Trek history for the cinema. And everything is still CG, but the CG has evolved so much in that time.
Yeah, definitely. I didn't want to take us off track. We could spend, another whole hour talking about just the designs, but let's delve into some of the story elements from, I guess we should start with the original 1979.
Yeah. And I think it's actually interesting to say that, because that's the era that actually produced as of right now, the most of the Star Trek films, and that there were six of them. But even within there, a lot of people would say you really do have the motion picture standing on its own. Then you have The Wrath of Khan through Voyage Home being sort of a second grouping, Whole Frontier being its own thing, and then Undiscovered Country sort of acting as a coda to 2, 3, and 4.
Mm-hmm.
I actually think that as far as from a narrative story structure, Star Trek's 1 and 5 are probably the most similar of the original six movies. Basically because, now, while they're very different vibes and feels of the film, and there's all kinds of flaws in each of these films in each of their own ways. The thing that's interesting about them is they're probably, you know, good or bad, most reflective of the original series of films or TV series.
Right.
You have Star Trek, the motion picture, being basically a remake of the Changeling, season two of the original series. And you have The Final Frontier, I being at best a remake of The Way to Eden.
Yeah, I didn't think about that, but you're right.
I feel like that's the best equivalent to it. And just like The Changeling is, hey, that's a pretty good, solid original series episode.
Yeah.
The Way to Eden is a pretty bad episode. And, you know, and they all have their groan, and it has its groan-tastic moments. I mean, I'm sure if you want to go on YouTube right now and look for Spock playing his harp, his Vulcan harp, with a space hippie, if you haven't seen that episode, you shouldn't, but you should at least go on YouTube and watch it, because it probably will blow your mind.
Yay, brother.
Oh, Herbert. Oh, man. Yes, that one's far out.
I mean, we've talked about it. We might as well touch a little bit about it. This episode is basically Star Trek special, you know, a very special episode of Star Trek, which is basically a message to teenage hippie saying don't do drugs and don't listen to gurus.
Yes, very much so with the guru message. And funny enough, you know, I think a few years ago, William Shatner actually admitted to having not rewatched most of the original Star Trek. And I think the only one he's admitted to rewatching is City on the Edge of Forever.
Fair.
And perhaps he watched Space Seed again. So he probably, in retrospect, when developing the concept for The Final Frontier, it's somewhere in the peripheral of his mind, he had Way to Eden. Suffice to say, when you look at the motion picture, the very first Star Trek film, you're looking at a film that structure is, first of all, very haphazardly put together compared to the other five original series movies. The movie was reportedly written with the first and second acts complete and no third act until they were literally filming it and going, all right, so what's going to happen next? And it shows. There is that flaw to the way that the film was made. In fact, there's an entire deleted sequence called a memory wall, where Kirk and Spock go inside of, and I'm just going to spoil it for anyone who hasn't seen the motion picture. They go inside V'ger, spacecraft, and discover sort of the memory banks of V'ger and explore it, and are attacked by V'ger's antibodies, so to speak. And it's supposed to be this riveting feature, which honestly, the only hint I ever had of it growing up as a Star Trek fan as a child was if you went to the Star Trek storybook adaption of the motion picture, it had still images of the sequence and a children's summary of that sequence. But otherwise, and I think you can find that on YouTube if you're curious to listen to it, a very rudimentary storytelling of the motion picture that's quite laughable to an adult, I think. But very simple. But that was only the only reference to that. Now, other than that, I think that the motion picture, it obviously has its own pacing problems and everything, and people can talk about that ad nauseum. I think the main thing to talk about here is the themes of the film and how we're building up on the character through the arcs of the story. Now, this film stands alone in the fact that while it is an Admiral/Captain Kirk story, more than it is a Dr. McCoy, and yes, we hardly see Spock for a good portion of the film, it becomes very much a Spock story as far as the Spock arc. We have Kirk, whose arc is, of course, that of, you know, I'm maybe a great captain, but I have no idea how the technology works, and my failings to know how this stuff works or having failed to read the manual seriously jeopardizes their mission. And then you have Spock, who's going from, and we're not really ever clear as to why, he's going for, and not surprisingly, for this thing called the Kolinar, which is to purge all remaining emotions from his psyche. And it's disturbed by the telepathic power of V'ger, which prompts Spock to stop what he's doing on Vulcan and go in search of V'ger. And it's interesting in that we have Spock going in search of V'ger to find answers to himself about, you know, logic and emotion. And V'ger, who's going in search of its creator, which comes down to it searching to understand the difference between its needs for logic, total logic, and emotion. You do have those two arcs of characters throughout the film. The Kirk arc just sort of abruptly drifts off by the third act, which is probably a casualty of the writing process of this film. Whereas the Spock one seems much more defined all the way to the end. In fact, the director's edition of the motion picture actually includes a couple of moments of Spock that are not included in the theatrical cut, which actually in many ways complete that connective energy and the connective tie. The moment where Spock turns and has a tear on his face and says, "Then I weep for V'ger as I weep for a brother," which that's problematic for Final Frontier. At the same time, we do have this understanding that we are connecting the V'ger story throughout the film to the Spock story, and they're tied to each other both narratively as well as telepathically.
I do think one thing I noticed about the motion picture is, first of all, when I first saw the motion picture, I was, when it first came out, I was a little bit too young to ever really grasp it. So when I was old enough to see it, there were parts of it I liked. Okay, this is a getting the band back together story. And then as you mentioned, in the second and third act, I'm like, what am I watching? And again, as you mentioned, the story perspective totally shifts. And it's kind of jarring if you're, you know, watching it for the first time, because you realize that the Kirk plot line, as you mentioned, drops off as soon as he gets exactly what he wants. And Spock continues on with this journey of self-discovery that amounts to, you know, it was a machine all along. As you mentioned, you know, remake of that classic episode. I can understand why maybe audiences in 1979, especially post Star Wars, we're going into it thinking, you know, this is going to be a barn burner. And what they get was a philosophical, psychological story. Maybe coming out of it thinking a little bit, you know, maybe a little bit disappointed. That said, I don't really know much about, like I said, the making of the movie enough to get an idea of what would have happened in that third act. Like you mentioned, the deleted scene, and I'm just trying to think to myself, what could Kirk's storyline have been? Has there been any discussion over what, did they have any plans on what Kirk's storyline would have been? Would it have evolved beyond, I've got the ship back, now I'm happy?
I mean, that's really what it comes down to. It really does feel like as soon as Spock comes on the ship and Kirk has that moment of going, Spock, it's like, thank God you're here, because I don't know what I'm doing, and now that you're here, the tension and the weight of my problems has gone away.
Which is interesting when you think about the role of a first officer on a ship. They're really the kind of the chief administrator of everything. So you do kind of get this sense that Kirk doesn't know how to do anything but sit in that chair and give orders.
Well, actually, I mean, Decker still maintains his title as first officer.
I forgot that. You're right.
And more so, what's even funny about it is that Decker is literally there to offer his advice for Kirk to shoot down and offer some sort of like contradiction to him.
Yeah.
But more importantly, Decker is basically there to sort of tech the tech for Kirk. It's funny because Kirk turns and has this relief looking at Spock, and Spock, who has been out of Starfleet, you know, possibly even longer than, you know, at least off of a starship. I mean, definitely longer than Kirk. And here he is. He's the one who's brought into the engine room and rebalances the warp drive so they can go back to warp after having this mishap that caused some sort of wormhole distortion issue. So it's interesting that Kirk has this relief with Spock, who knows less about the new starship than he does.
Right.
And I just wonder if Spock just off camera opened the user manual and read it, whereas Kirk just sat there and, It was like, oh, thank God somebody else knows it.
I will say this, Star Trek The Motion Picture has my favorite introduction of Bones, you know, into the film, into the story. My all-time favorite introduction to Bones, where he's basically pissed off and grouchy. I got drafted. This is your fault. And, you know, of course, you know, he will, of course, return to help his friend. But I just loved how instantly irascible Bones was, and DeForest Kelly played him. I just have to mention that.
Oh yeah, and of course, just seeing DeForest Kelly with the beard and the medallion.
Oh yeah, the sexy 70s disco medallion. Yeah,
disco Bones. That said, I mean, he does also have one of the best lines, I think, of the entire film at that moment too, where he walks out of the transporter room and he says, you know, in regards to the totally redesigned Enterprise, and then he says, and they probably redesigned sickbay too. I know engineers, they love to change things.
Yeah.
It's just such a great moment, because I don't think there's that many memorable quotable lines that you can out of context quote from this film. But that to me at least is one.
It's also kind of telling, because as we'll see, you know, the design of the ship and design of everything is going to completely change from the motion picture to the next movie, Wrath of Khan. I don't know how much we can say about Wrath of Khan that hasn't already been said.
No, I mean, there really hasn't been. I mean, that's why I was thinking also that you really have to look at 2, 3, and 4 as a trilogy. With the third act, or the second act, I mean, first act being the encounter with Khan and the introduction of the Genesis device, and the death of Spock being sort of the finale of that second film, to the second act of it being about the resurrection of Spock and the resolving of the Genesis device, and now introducing the a new challenge, which is, of course, Kirk and crew destroying the Enterprise and now being in defiance of Starfleet and now being renegades and needing to, of course, return home. And what does that journey home look like for them? What is that penance that they must pay to be able to walk back through the door? And you go, this goes all the way back to, you know, the Odyssey. You know, Odysseus goes on his quest after the war at Troy, and you know, encounters all these different things on his way home, finally to be able to come home to rest at the bedside of his wife. And we're looking at the same thing in retrospect with the second, third, and fourth Trek films, because they've gone out on this great quest regarding Genesis, and it's led them through all these thicks and thins and sacrifices that they've made, and people that they've lost and regained, and people that they've lost and never regained, and people that have stepped aside for whatever reasons, and all in this, and then in different penances that each character sacrifices that they've made in order to finally come to their final journey, whether it was going back in time to save the present with whales from the 1980s, or whether it was, you know, destroying the Enterprise to off the crew of a Klingon bird of prey. There's all these sacrifices that were made. And then, of course, the biggest one that's most notably of the three is the death of Spock and his sacrifice for the good of the Enterprise.
One thing I will say, and you're absolutely right, those three films form one whole complete story. They serve as you can look at it as a trilogy, or again, Act 1, Act 2, Act 3. And one thing I've noticed is that Act 1 and Act 2 sort of ramp up the stakes for our characters. You know, by the end of Act 2, Kirk is without his ship. He, you know, was without his best friend. He's got him back, but he's not at 100%. He doesn't have full grasp of all of his faculties or memories. You know, he's flying around in an enemy ship. And then the third act does something that most third acts don't do. And I know this may be part of how this may not fully have been conceived totally as a third act. But, you know, most third act stories build up to a grand guignol, this huge, you know, Wagnerian battle. You can look at any other franchise where you have, you know, a trilogy, and most of them, if they merit a trilogy of films, then there's some sort of fighting, unless you're talking about Before Sunrise, or with other notable exceptions. But, you know, so usually the third act is this grand guignol, beat the bad guy, save the day. And this third act doesn't do that. It gives you the closest they can to a comedy that's really lighthearted. You can take your kids to see it and they're fine. You know, there's no blood. There's no guts.
Well, there are blood and guts. It's in that whale video.
Oh, but yes, that's true. Yeah.
Spoiler alert.
But, you know, there's hardly any, you know, there's no phaser, you know, there's no running and gunning. So what this leaves you on is something that's very uniquely Trek. Hope. And not just any kind of hope. It also comes with this environmental message as well. Like, please, you know, don't render species endangered. You know, I think that that's, again, if you look at it as a three-part story, ending the story not with a big brawl for it all, but with, we're going to save the day with whales. You know, that's a hell of a way to end your story, and somehow it just works.
Yeah, I mean, it is actually the motion picture, while it does have the quasi-villain in V'ger, and of course we have Khan, and then we have Krug, Voyage Home does not really have a villain to speak of, other than man itself as a species. We are the villain of the story.
And how Star Trek is that?
No, no. It's the most, I would say, narratively, Voyage Home probably fits the structure and tone of like a season two episode of the original series.
Totally. If they could have afforded something like The Voyage Home in season two, we'd be praising it as the greatest episode or one of the greatest episodes ever.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. But, you know, generally speaking, yeah, you do have that one, two, you do have that two, three, four and sort of this unofficial trilogy. And maybe it is a little too much to, you know, as I described it to begin with, as a first, second and third act, just because the tone change is so significant. I mean, if you wrote that as a single, try to jam that into a single feature, you wouldn't even have, you would have trouble not only just jamming everything in and making it work, you would have trouble trying to adjust the tone, because all of a sudden the third act, you take this like left turn to go. I mean, think about the reviews of the critics would say, like, all of a sudden there's this left turn and they just decide to go find some whales.
Right. Yeah. It'd be insane. Like, can you imagine if at the end of, you know, to speak of another franchise, at the end of the big Avengers movie, it's like, no, we got to go to space and save these peaceful little creatures that just fly around. That's how we beat Thanos.
Be like, okay.
Yeah. It would shatter minds. And again, somehow this works. To continue on with the next movie, a lot of things in that one don't work.
You know what? I will say, looking back at it in retrospect, the amount of things that don't work in it are very blatant that don't work.
Yeah.
But the things that do work actually work really well. I'm really surprised how well they've held up. In fact, I almost want to look back and see what other movies were nominated for the Razzie in 1989, because I think that you know, I'm just curious, how badly has that Razzie Award for that year held up?
Yeah.
I mean, people laugh about that movie, but so many people quote, you know, what does God need with a starship? Or, you know, I want my pain, I need my pain. And in fact, that's actually interesting, because that movie has some very interesting thematics. It's about, you know, it really is about, you know, you can't just wash away your pain and suffering in your life and make you a better person. In fact, the pain and suffering is actually what makes you a stronger human being and is able to make better choices and better decisions in your life and better, you know, outcomes. And that's the price of learning from failure and from mistakes. And you know, the movie really grapples with that at its very heart. Now, how well does it really kind of put it all together in the end, and what was the point of going to find God, and like what's up with the turbo shaft on the Enterprise and the weird graphics and, you know, the Klingon captain with the weird demands and stuff to taking target practice shots on an old NASA space probe. I mean, yeah. I mean, the first time I saw that, I thought, like, is this some sort of callback to V'ger? You know, I mean, there's a lot of flaws in that film, but the cinematography is really good. I think the thematics of the film are actually some of the most pronounced. of the Star Trek movie universe as a whole. I think we have our best scene with Dr. McCoy of any movie.
Agreed.
It's hard for me to just label it the outcast that I once believed it to be. And even its structure of the film is actually not bad. It's the execution of that structure that is the failing of the film. It is the execution of the production design. It is the execution of all these different elements, which is failing in the film. But it does, you know, now getting Kirk being chased by rock creatures and all the stuff that Shatner wants in his special director's version or whatever, would that actually help the film be any better? No, there's way too many goddamn plot holes in this movie. Way too many. And the novel, and if anybody ever takes the time to go read the novelization of the film, the novel is probably one of the longer Star Trek novels because it spends so much of its time explaining the plot holes of the film.
Would you like to know which other films were nominated alongside Star Trek V: The Final Frontier? These are the 10th Annual Golden Raspberry Awards.
Was one of them Weekend at Bernie's?
Let me tell you something. I don't think that movie was nominated for a Razzie, which is surprising.
Weekend at Bernie's 2 definitely belongs on a Razzie nomination. Just watch the trailer. Anybody who's curious about this, please just go watch the trailer to Weekend at Bernie's 2. That is a movie that has jumped the shark.
Don't torture yourself by watching it. Please don't.
Oh, dear Lord.
Alongside Star Trek V: The Final Frontier nominated The Karate Kid Part 3.
Fair.
Lock Up. Roadhouse, which is looked quite a bit more favorably, I guess, in hindsight. And something called Speed Zone. I have no idea what that is.
Not to get into off of our Story Trek vibe here, but I just want to make the point that it is the worst of the original series films. I certainly wouldn't categorize it as the worst Trek film. It does not deserve its categorization of the Razzies in retrospect, though.
Yeah. I will say one thing about Star Trek V. I always found the plot tantalizing and just poorly executed, because if you think about it, the plot is if I recall correctly, this was a part of the development, you know, as evangelicalism has a resurgence in the 1980s, you have TV evangelists, you have Jim Baker. So Cybok was intended to be evocative of those figures. And that's a really interesting place that I don't think Trek even really tried to touch on in that way until you get to Deep Space Nine, and you have various storylines about the Bajoran religion and who is their emissary. Is it this person? Is it this person? Who are you supposed to trust as, you know, the spokesperson for your god or gods? So I always found that tantalizing and interesting about Star Trek V. It just did not live up to the potential that it had.
No, it really didn't. But it's not as bad as some people would have you believe it is. It's bad, but it's not as bad as you think it is. That said, a movie that strangely enough some people consider to be a bad film is Star Trek VI, and I know Gene Roddenberry, you know, saw it, and then, you know, according to Nick Meyer, and he's not trying to make too much of a glib about it, but you know, Gene Roddenberry saw it and 2 days later died.
Oh my.
Ed Gene considered it to be the absolute most, the worst Star Trek film of the films that he'd seen.
Really? Mainly,
yeah, because he did not like the idea of Kirk being racist. He didn't like the whole racist themes motifs of the film. You know, that was a bridge too far. Like the other stuff in the film, he was like, okay, I can, you know, you guys have already done all these things, got it, you know. And I mean Gene Roddenberry also hated The Voyage Home, so
well, yeah, fair.
Gene hated every movie after the motion picture that was released until his death, so it's not really fair to necessarily lump, but you know, to say that, you know, this is the movie that Roddenberry hated of all of them. But it was certainly the one where he never was able to publicly express his feelings about it because he passed away so quickly. It was just known that, you know, he saw the film, and at the end of the screening, Nick Meyer attests this story, as well as some of the producers of the film, that Roddenberry got in a very heated discussion with Nick Meyer about the film and had reservations even when the screenplay was being drafted up about the entire notion of Kirk being sort of, you know, cast as this you know, racist bigot, and then the crew of the Enterprise, and then of course character of Savick being used as sort of the arch villain on the ship and responsible for so much of the conspiracy. So yeah, just to say that, you know, that movie does, you know, I do think that we probably would, if it weren't for the fact that five directly preceded it, I sometimes wonder if six would have been considered part of the 2-4 story, and it would have been 2, 3, 4, 6. You know, by Star Trek VI, it's like the band is all separated. You know, they're pretty near to retirement. So it's like there's this weird gap of, hey, we've been reborn into a crew that's going to go out on more adventures and zip off into the distance. And then in six, it's like, all right, I just bought a boat.
Yeah. Right.
So I, you know, it's there is this jump there that really doesn't ever get addressed, that leap. I mean, it's a very natural leap in many ways. And I mean, contextually, everyone, I think, going into the theaters, I mean, I think you'd be really hard pressed to find a Star Trek fan that didn't see, especially by the end of the film, that didn't see The Undiscovered Country as the finale of the original series films.
Now, I will say that The Undiscovered Country is actually quite possibly my favorite of all the Star Trek movies for a couple of different reasons. Part of them is that specific plot line about Kirk that, and I felt like it was, there was always kind of an undercurrent of bigotry towards Klingons with Kirk, even all the way back to the Organian incident.
Errand of Mercy.
Errand of Mercy. Thank you. So all the way back to that, Kirk has always had just a little bit more irrational intensity when it comes to Klingons. So I felt like it was a perfect capstone to address that and finally have that plot line resolved with his character, especially after the fact that it played into the events of the search for Spock, where his son was killed. It wasn't just irrational racism. I felt like that finally gave him a justification for feeling that way and an out, an opportunity for redemption for his character. I love the story. I love the fact that it is a murder mystery with Spock as Sherlock Holmes. I love the fact that it is kind of a genre bender, right? Because it's a political theater, a political thriller, and it's a murder mystery, and it's a prison breakout story, and it's a race against time story, and it's still Star Trek. Yep. And how did you work all of those things into one film? And it works.
Well, Nick Meyer, I mean, a lot of people say that the even number of Star Trek films of the original series are the best. I think that the reality is the ones that had Nick Meyer writing some of it are the best.
I cannot disagree. They're obviously on my list of favorites.
2, 4, 6, people consider the best, many people consider the best of the original Star Trek, and you can rearrange those three particularly in whatever order you prefer. But those, though, arguably are the three that usually end up on people's number one on their list. And when you consider that, the 2, 4, 6 usually do that. They all have in common Nick Meyer either being the co-writer. We really aren't really clear about his writing on Wrath of Khan other than the fact that he took a bunch of dysfunctional scripts and made them into one, like, supposedly in less than 2 weeks.
Wow, yeah.
I mean, and then it was so quickly, he didn't even bother to negotiate his writing credit on the film. And so he never got writing credit for the film. But apparently he wrote that film by himself based off of a bunch of discarded drafts from other writers. Apparently, as I understand it, Nick Meyer just kind of sat there and, you know, made notes of what everybody thought were like the best bits of each one and kind of noted those sections as well as what he liked. And then went away, took those elements and came back with a whole new script. And pretty much what Wrath of Khan was filmed at, as I understand it, it's literally like a second draft from Nick Meyer, which was very different, was not that different from his first draft. That is one of those times where you can definitely say the luxury of a deadline certainly propelled this film to its success. I don't think anyone's going to call Wrath of Khan a failure in any way.
Not at all. Now, Star Trek Generations, on the other hand, I wouldn't call it a failure. Some people don't look favorably on it. The thing I like about it and the thing I can criticize about it is that it's one big episode of The Next Generation with the big special guest star you all hoped would show up.
It really is. And I mean, the weird thing is, and looking back at it, I had this strange discovery that one has the most skewed three-act structure of any of the Star Trek films. Because you think in your head, okay, what's the first act about? The first act is about Soren. The
Soren.
first act is about Soren getting into the Nexus. And so in your mind, it really feels like the act one break is either destruction of the Enterprise, Soren getting the Nexus, which basically happened back to back in the movie. That's sort of that act one break. But the reality is that actually comes at like the halfway mark of the movie. So the first act break that they probably drew this movie up with was somewhere much earlier, and I haven't really figured out what that act one break, scripted is. I just can't, for the life of me, nothing sticks out to me as like a first act break. I don't know what you think, but
Do you remember at what point Picard finds out his brother and nephew died? Could that be it? Or is that
well,
too early?
that was too early because that happens like they have the whole scene on the holodeck with Worf getting his promotion. He walks outside, computer Arch, what's the news? My brother and his kids died. It's like, okay, that's the inciting incident, but that's not a first act break. So that happens really, or that happens right on time. And then there's this massive gulf where nothing really I would categorize as, I mean, in a weird way, I guess your first act break could perhaps be, well, then again, maybe that is your first act break with Picard, because there is this sort of like prologue, which is on the Enterprise B, and Kirk, and maybe that's the inciting incident of it, and then Kirk getting sucked out into the Nexus, or blown out, or whatever. But it doesn't make any sense just because it's like these two paralleling storylines that. And because you kind of get the impression, because you're talking about two different timelines that were shifting back and forth, not through time travel, but just through editorial, that this is like some sort of parallel storytelling. And then we come to realize that the stories are going to connect later. But because that parallel storytelling device disappears after that initial beat of the film, we're left to think that we really haven't seen a true first act break. And that's why I keep going back to the Soren getting into the Nexus, Enterprise crashing. That always feels like the first act break. Yet that's well past, well into like the midway point or slightly past midway point of the film. And then I also thought forever in my mind, oh, Kirk and Picard, they meet each other, that's the end of the second act, and Picard can't get him to come back, and it's like, getting Kirk to come back out of the Nexus, that's like the second act break to the third act. And that's probably true, but that whole period of time in the movie is like 20 minutes, 15 minutes. It's nothing. And then it's like, then you have sort of this proper third act, which the execution of it is questionable, of course, with the death of Kirk. And it's like, well, did it really pay off? And people are always like, well, Kirk's death didn't really mean much. It's like, well, how much would have Spock's death meant if you didn't have the earlier scene in Kirk's quarters where Spock says to Kirk, and reemphasizes for anybody who's new to the franchise, I'm a Vulcan, I have no ego to bruise. You proceed from a false assumption, Jim. You are my superior officer, you're my friend. I have been and always shall be your friend. All that stuff comes early on in the film, in the first act, or slightly into the second act, actually. Whereas in this film, we don't really have much of a setup for the death of Kirk. We don't see we saw Kirk as a hero in saving these people off the ship, and so we get this like Kirk is a hero, Kirk is a hero once again, but we didn't track him for basically a whole act of the movie. He disappears. We start off at the beginning of the film with Kirk, and then we end and then end with him at the end. And I don't really know what the fix is. I don't, to be honest, I don't really care. I this movie, to me, it was more misguided in its whole notion of wanting to join up Kirk and Picard together in one movie and sort of bill it as that. I think that was the bigger mistake. Ron Moore and Brandon Braga often said that, they felt that, All Good Things, the series finale for The Next Generation, would have made a better was a better written 2-hour movie than Generations was.
Totally.
They've at length bashed their own writing of this film. And it's just funny that they wrote the finale of the original TNG series, which was considered by many one of the best of the episodes. And then they write this really lackluster movie right at the same time.
One thing I was going to mention about Generations is that it felt, as I was watching it, something about it felt very slapdash. Like this was made very quickly or hurriedly. And one thing that I noticed, and this is not much to do with story, but if you notice, LeVar Burton in that movie is wearing Cole Meany's uniform from Deep Space Nine. And there's a moment where he's walking where the sleeves are over his hands. And I'm like, what, why is he wearing that? And so that's really the only one thing I wanted to add on to Generations is that, you know, it felt like it was put together very quickly. And so the story does seem to reflect that, you know, like this was, again, like I said, it seems like just a run of the mill special guest episode, if they could have afforded Shatner's fee for a TV show.
Yeah, I mean, there definitely is that feel to the film in the end. One thing to point out, though, in knowing a little bit about the history of the uniform situation on Generations, is that there actually was a special uniform that was being made for Generations. And in the end, for some reason, it was either too cost prohibitive to mass produce it, or there was some sort of like dislike of it at the very end by an executive producer, probably Rick Berman, that they jettisoned it and they said, well, we got to do something different. Let's use the DS9 uniforms. They're not filming right now. And they just grabbed them off the shelf and threw them on people. I think Patrick Stewart is actually wearing Avery Brooks's uniform.
Wow.
But actually, as a callback, as I understand it, the show Lower Decks, the uniforms in there are actually what the uniforms were, are an homage to those rejected uniforms.
Interesting. Did not know that.
Yeah. So if you were curious what they are, as I understand it, the Lower Decks uniforms are based on the rejected Generations uniform, which kind of makes sense. The whole show is about rejected stuff, right?
Right.
The other thing to note about the Next Generation movies as opposed to the original series movies, I was thinking, is that the Next Generation movies don't really tie together as much with the story threads as the movie series of the original series does. I mean, yeah, you do have the bit where we do see in Generations that Data has an emotion chip that fuses in, and then we see him turn it on and off in First Contact. But then that emotion chip just kind of like drifts away for the last two. It's sort of there when it needs to be, and it's gone the next minute. I mean, Riker shaving off his beard in Insurrection. Does he have a beard off again in Nemesis? Nope, back.
Right.
You know, I think we have the Deanna Troi resurrection of her relationship with Riker that kind of kicks off again in First Contact, and then that's, you know, blossomed in Nemesis, for what it's worth.
Oh, Nemesis.
And, that one is a different story. But... by and large, those movies just aren't that well connected to each other, and they really do feel all together as a whole, not individually, but as a whole. They do feel separated the same way you would see on a TV series that was turning out episodes every week.
Totally. I mean, yeah, I've never noticed before, but they are totally episodic, and it's interesting. So here's just me thinking out loud about that. Does that have anything to do with the way film production, you know, or films would have been greenlit at that time? Because we're talking the 90s, and we're talking like everybody expects a blockbuster, right?
Well,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, I mean, the blockbuster mentality started in the mid-70s, late 70s.
This is true, in the late 70s with Jaws and, you know, Star Wars. But I guess what I meant sorry?
I didn't say anything.
Oh, sorry. I must have heard my own echo. That's weird. But I guess if anything, like would it be frowned upon, or would it have been less possible with production teams or films at that time to have them connect the Next Generation stories? Or is that just something that, you know, they had the opportunity, it was on the plate, they just didn't go for it for whatever various reasons?
Well, I mean, I do know that the development process for the Next Generation movies was radically different from the original series movies. I mean, the original series movies were constantly this battle of, you know, well, I think this might be the last time we do it. All right, this is going to be the last time we make a movie. And then movie successful. Okay, I guess we're going to do another one. And then in the case of Star Trek V, it was like, oh God, this can't be the last one. It was so bad. We got to do another one because the last one was just that bad. And plus the 25th anniversary is coming up. We got to do something. And then that's what prompted 6 to happen. 4 was obviously a continuation of 3, and you know, they were like, oh, 3 did pretty well. Nimoy, you want to direct again? I mean, so each of the original series movies were piggybacked off the last one, both from their successes and failures, but as well as the narrative, because, you know, strangely enough, the original series TV series, the episodes super, 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 super rarely connected to each other.
Right.
And yet the Star Trek original series movies are very much connected to each other, at least 2, 3, 4, and 6. And when you get to the Next Generation movies, it's like you can almost swap them as far as their narrative structures, because those movies are also separated from each other. They all stand alone. In fact, it's even funny to me because the first two are written by Ronald Moore and Brandon Braga. The second and third of those four movies are directed by Jonathan Frakes. And you would think there'd be some sort of carryover, but there's not.
Yeah, the only thing that seems to carry over is that these characters, and I feel like it's an opportunity to tell how actors and performances tell story, because really, if it weren't for, you know, the way these actors performed, as if we're already all familiar with each other, each one of these could be a completely separate space adventure in any other franchise outside of Star Trek. I mean, with the exception of some, you know, aspects of it, I don't think you could do First Contact anywhere. But I feel like if you did not have the original series and the relationship with these characters, their connections, I don't think that you can say that these are specifically Star Trek without these characters. I feel like in the Next Generation movies, their relationship is the only glue you have to the series.
That's very true. Very true. And I think, you know, last time we were talking about canon, I mentioned that Star Trek V is outside of canon in many ways. I'd argue, actually, thinking more about it in retrospect, that Insurrection is also potentially out of canon as well. There's nothing in it that ever is called back again.
I can see that. I hadn't considered that before, but if you think about it, this admiral comes out of nowhere. This area of space comes out of nowhere. And I get that, of course, you want to create new things. Like galaxies are a big damn thing. So you can't possibly have explored every single area of space, no matter how many episodes of Star Trek you've done. At the same time, this feels tacked on out of nowhere. I'm not saying that it had to have been the Cardassians, even though, frankly, I think with the special effects budget they spent on the, I can't remember their names. I remember the leader's name, Ruafo. But for the amount of effects you could have spent on them, you could have made them Cardassians and had just some slight texture of connection that made this a little bit more plausible. But all of a sudden, out of nowhere, you have this nefarious plot with this Star Trek admiral, and it just feels like you're throwing a lot at me and it's not sticking to the wall.
I mean, That's really the problem with the Next Generation movies, is they just all feel very episodic. They feel like hour and a half, 2 hour episodes. The characterizations of everybody are pretty flat for the most part overall, other than, of course, Data and Picard. Those seem to be the two that they tend to develop. Obviously, Riker doesn't get much development time in the second and third of those movies because he's behind the director's monitor. That makes sense. But you know, all in all, the movies for The Next Generation, I honestly, when those started, went into those films feeling, for each of them, I had the highest expectations of them because they were coming off of The Next Generation series, which had been so good. And you thought, the show is so good, they're bound to make better movies out of it. Right. I mean, look what they did with the original series. The original series is good, but not as good as TNG. And they made those into great movies. What's going on here? Why are these movies not working? And I just think, by and large, it comes down to failure of imagination. I feel like it comes down to, whereas the original series movies were telling sort of a bigger story through each individual piece for the most part, I think The Next Generation decided to compartmentalize each of their stories for better or worse. And as a result, you didn't get any payoff from having seen the other ones, nor do the stories carry over. So everything just kind of resets. I mean, First Contact really kind of gave us the hope, at least in it being the second one, like, oh, okay, I see where they're going with this. You know, we've got Marina Sirtis as Troi. She's much better, much more developed character now. We've got Data in control of his emotions a little bit. But in the end of the film, we're not really left with anything that's like a dangling thread. Like at Wrath of Khan, at the end of it, we got this dangling thread of Spock is dead, but maybe he's still, maybe there's a way to bring him back. Like, there's that dangling thread. There's no dangling thread in First Contact. There's nothing that makes me think the next movie has a step to leap off of. And at the end of Insurrection, there's no step for it to leap off of. And that's the problem, is that there's nowhere to take the movies forward, good or bad. First Contact had the great opportunity to take it forward, but I think its biggest failing is it did not take a step at the end to lead us to what Insurrection should inevitably be. And I think that that's what it needed, and that's where Star Trek works really well as a series, is it resets every week for a different story, and it works for television. But in a theatrical sense, if you're telling a continuous series of stories, there is a desire, there is a need for us to see these stories as a franchise to connect to one another a little bit more tangibly. So when Insurrection takes this completely left turn about the Baku.
That's them.
Yeah. You're just like, wait, Baku? Okay, so how does this connect with the Borg? How does this connect with, you know, Starfleet being decimated? Wait, and Worf's back on the ship. Where was he? I wasn't watching Deep Space Nine, so where was he? I'm confused. So it's just like the movies in the TNG era just expected you to be watching any and all things Star Trek, but at the same time, reset themselves as if you'd never watched Star Trek, and at the same time, gave you as a viewer no expectation of things to come.
One thing that, you know, about Insurrection, obviously there was a script there and everybody wanted to make a good story. Nemesis, by contrast. So here's the heartbreaking thing I always felt about Nemesis, is that reading the script of it, I'm like, this is written by somebody who knows the next generation and likes it. And seeing the direction and the end result is a very clear example of how, if a director does not give a damn about anything that's going on, it's going to show on screen. And I think that Nemesis is just full of so many missed opportunities. I don't know. I believe it was John Logan.
John Logan was the credited writer on it. Yeah.
Yeah. In the early 2000s, when through various means you could get your hands on a copy of a script and, you know, read over and things. I read over the script for Nemesis, and I'm like, wow, this is really cool. There's some callbacks here. There's some throwbacks, you know, there's some notes here. And while I felt that it wasn't the best send off, even in script form for the next generation cast, it was again written by somebody who tried to summarize their adventures. You know, it was someone who attempted to, you know, leave you with some sort of, this is the end of their journey. They're not going to come back again. Even the death of Data, spoiler alert for a movie that came out almost 20 years ago, even the death of Data was played differently. And then you see it played out and you're like, all the words are the same, but this feels really different than from what I read. And it was difficult for me to put my finger on what exactly was wrong. And I can't think of anything other than the direction. Nobody looked like they wanted to be there.
No, it's definitely a movie that, you know, I mean, I don't blame Myrna Surtees for what happened with the character of Troi in this movie, for her not wanting to be there. But I mean, this movie as a whole, just the only moment that you get any sense of joy is with Patrick Stewart riding around on the dune buggy at the beginning. And to me, like, I was just like, hey, if I wanted to make Fast and the Furious in Star Trek, this is your moment right here. Aside from that, the movie doesn't really have much joy in it anywhere. I mean, I think it's pretty telling that the first season of Picard feels like it's almost like doing a redemption arc for the making of Nemesis.
It's striking you say that, because one thing I felt about Picard, it's that, like, it's been almost 20 years and everybody in the show is still recovering from Nemesis.
Yeah, I mean, the characters who were damaged the most in Nemesis, I think, were the ones who actually were brought back in season one. We had everybody from Rena Sirtis having some of her best scenes in all of Star Trek.
Yeah.
In Picard, we had actually Patrick Stewart just playing off, just being himself and guiding us through the story. We're getting Brent Spiner's Data finally getting a good death, as opposed to just being, casually tossed aside.
Right.
And Riker not just being the dutiful first officer, but actually being a bit of a hero in the story. So yeah, we don't have obviously didn't have all the other characters, but they were peripheral and Nemesis, and in many ways, I think that's a good thing because they weren't wronged.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look at what they did to Troy. God knows what they'd have done to Dr. Crusher.
Oh God. Yeah. So I like I said, I almost feel like they kind of sat there and went, okay, who was wronged most by Nemesis? And then we're gonna make that the show.
Yeah.
And with that, I think that that was kind of the moment where the movies had sort of burned their course out and, dwindled away. And for 7 to 8 years, there were no Star Trek films. And I think that was a good thing in many ways in retrospect. And there was some time to reevaluate things from a perspective of what works for a Star Trek movie and what doesn't. And I think with the next three films in the Kelvin universe, we came across a period of Star Trek where the stories are somewhat connected, at least as far as character development. And that's questionable, but they're somewhat connected. They're somewhat connected because of the whole Kelvin timeline thing, and, does Beyond connect to it? Well, yeah, because there was the Makos and stuff like that, and they were affected by things in the Kelvin timeline. We see this leap forward in Star Trek where, we're able to dive hard into the sort of nostalgia of Star Trek's past with the Kelvin movies. We're also able to augment it with a lot of modernization of sort of established tropes, if you will.
I have a uneasy relationship with the Kelvin movies. Like the 2009 Star Trek, I look at that and I'm like, it's not what I remember of Trek, but if you were to repackage this for a new audience, I can't think of any way you could do it better. From the, it's not exactly a reboot, it is a alternate universe created by time travel. Very Star Trek. Yeah, it goes back to the original series even. In modern times, yes, you would need to make our classic trio of heroes from Kirk, Spock, and McCoy, which you do see a little, you do get a little bit of that aesthetic, but you also switch it to making it Kirk, Spock, and Uhura, finally elevating Uhura to us an essential character. And again, I think that you do have a little bit of connective tissue through Spock. He seems to be, the through line for at least the first two pictures, in terms of how I do think his character does have some sort of shallow development over one and two, and they attempt to kind of continue that in three, but I don't think it really pays off. From the Spock that we knew, who is the, strict martinet, as Patrick Stewart described Data in Nemesis, to, being somewhat more friendly on a more friendly relationship with Kirk at the end of the 2009 first Star Trek movie. And then you have his, this was baffling to me that can you have them at an easy point at the end of the first movie. And then by Into Darkness, you're right back to them at odds again. And I'm like, why did you regress this plot line backwards just for the sake of drama? We could go, I don't really, the uneasy is the uneasiness with this Kelvin trilogy is the fact that I just don't really like Star Trek Into Darkness.
A resounding thing between you and me is that we can both agree Into Darkness is the worst of the Kelvin timeline movies. It's not even, in my mind, it's not even debatable.
Hands down, hands down. Like Star Trek Beyond, I feel like it does miss the mark, but it aimed for the mark. And Star Trek Into Darkness said, I don't care where the mark is, it's Star Trek.
Yeah, Into Darkness basically said the way to make a Star Trek movie is we're going to take the most beloved Star Trek movie, slap a new coat of paint on it, rearrange a couple of deck chairs on it, and ship it out there to the public for mass consumption. Oh yeah, we're going to throw in the most blatant sexism in Star Trek that we've had, other than I guess there is the weird nemesis moment, but sort of like the casualness of it, and frivolity of it, is the most I've seen since like the original series. I mean, we take Uhura, who we start to set up as this complicated, more sophisticated character in the first one, who's into linguistics and, you know, becomes this, you know, relationship where she's trying to figure out with her and Spock, and it turns it into like the, you know, she has this like bickering relationship with Spock that Kirk is like awkwardly in between. You know, it's just like, well, what did we need that for? Why have we reduced Uhura to this?
Right.
Like, you brought her up and now you're bringing her down. And then all of a sudden we're going to throw in Dr. Carol Marcus. And instead of making her the sophisticated woman that we saw in the original Wrath of Khan, we're going to turn her into this attractive girl in a short skirt. And, oh, by the way, we're just going to have this random scene of her in her lingerie.
Right.
That is absolutely like no purpose to, but you know, it looked good in the trailer kind of thing. And that's the problem I have with In a Darkness, is that there's just this frivolity to it. And it's just like, okay, we're going to kill a character, bring him back. We're going to call him John Harrison, even though he's Khan Noonien Singh and he's a white guy, strangely. I mean, we're not going to bother with any of this stuff. We're just going to like go with it. And it's just disappointing on so many levels. I mean, yeah, they connect the storyline, and yes, there is the USS Vengeance that's created in this movie, and the Vengeance is created as a result of the Narada that was created in 2009 Star Trek from the Romulans. It's supposed to be a reaction to that. I get it. So they're carrying that story forward. There is the reaction in Into Darkness that they felt like, oh, Kirk got to the captain's chair too easy, so now we're going to regress him a little bit. That was the actual solution that the writers pointed forward with. So, you know, they purposely regressed the character because of criticism that they felt he got there too easily. So the movie just takes a lot of hits, and it deserves it though. It's also the longest runtime of any Star Trek film.
Is it really? Yeah. That's disturbing, because I mean, it feels like it should not have that much. I would rather have more time with the whales.
The motion picture is shorter than Into Darkness.
That's insane. Yeah, so there's so much about Into Darkness that just is the fact that you set up Uhura as a linguist, and someone who knows thousands or at least hundreds or dozens of languages. And the first time she uses them against the Klingons, it's totally useless, as if she had no full understanding of Klingon culture at all. She just spoke the language, which is possible, but tell me that. All the way down to, I know I've said this many times to friends, and when they ask me, what is your problem with Star Trek Into Darkness? I say, I can sum it up with one sentence. Captain Kirk kickstarts an antimatter engine. What? Why? How? That's it. Full period, full stop.
Yeah, because that's how everything works in movies. You just physically have to kick it or throw it or grab it.
Yeah. Tells me, like, you just didn't care. You just did not care. He fixes it somehow.
Yeah. I mean, there's just that, and then the Spock like jumping from platform to platform chasing after Khan, and like sort of this weird like Star Wars Jedi thing from I think it was like Attack of the Clones started with that.
Oh, yeah.
Anakin like jumping from platform to platform. And I'm like, last I checked, Spock isn't a Jedi. He doesn't have superpowers. And yet him and Khan have these super exaggerated powers that they're just making these jumps and leaps. And I always find that kind of stuff in movies to be a bit distracting, especially when people don't have like superhero strength. Even in superhero movies, I'm like, well, you're not impervious to these things. Why are you suddenly impervious to making these kinds of jumps? But anyway, I digress. Point is, Into Darkness blows. And Beyond, for all of its good that it tries to make on itself. And interestingly enough, Beyond does this weird thing where it tries to call back in almost like the echoes of the motion picture. And it's really interesting because it's like it finds itself like almost telling the story, an alternate story of how Kirk, Spock, and the original 5-year mission ended. Because the film starts with sort of the question of, Kirk, you've been offered an admiral position. Spock, you know, maybe it's time to get away from all these humans. and, you know, rekindled with Vulcan. And you have to wonder if that was some of the same stuff that led in sort of background character wise to the motion picture. And yet we clearly see these characters make a different choice. Kirk decides not to become an admiral. He declines to be promoted, which is one of the things that, you know, you remember Kirk says to Picard in Generations, he says, don't ever let them promote you.
Right.
You know, and then here and beyond, this Kirk doesn't let them promote him. We see Spock decide, you know what, I'm not going to go undergo Colin R or whatever he's thinking about at that time. I'm going to stay with the ship. And the Enterprise gets, you know, not gets rebuilt rather than a refit. But ends up looking the same, basically.
Yeah.
Which I was so disappointed by. I was like, that's your opportunity to come back and build. Like, you want to put the 50th anniversary, because that was the year it came out for the 50th. You want to put a nice little bow on this movie. You end with that ship coming back looking like the motion picture Enterprise or the original series Enterprise, one of those two, and you're going to have like the biggest fan applause you've ever seen. Simple fan nod, and you know, and you get the biggest applause you get out of that movie.
Right.
Instead, the most emotional moment of the film for me is the moment where, of all things, Zachary Quinto's Spock pulls out a photograph of Leonard Nimoy's crew of the Enterprise sitting what's actually a publicity photo for Star Trek V. And that evokes the greatest emotion to me. And like I said, last one, that's the only callback to Final Frontier in any other form in Star Trek.
Yeah. I forgot that is the only other time that it's mentioned. So I'm excited to see if the Kelvin universe with the reported next movie to come out is going to course correct and give us something like, as you mentioned before, maybe it is, you know, like they advance into, we're now in the motion picture type era, just with different costumes and less 70s medallions.
I don't know. I could go for the 70s medallions.
I could go for Carl Urban in a 70s medallion with the, you know, way open, too low V-neck. That's what I was hoping for. I hope to see the next Star Trek movie just kind of don't take us where we've already been. Take us someplace we haven't been before, but don't give us the Baku and don't redo the Borg again.
Yeah. I mean, that's, I think the big takeaway also is, and Gene Roddenberry aptly, you got this part right. The Enterprise is a character. Robert Wise understood this actually when trying to score a motion picture. The Enterprise is a character. If you don't score the Enterprise as a character, you're missing a point. You know, there was the, in Voyage Home, the original Harve Bennett treatment for Voyage Home was that they were, our notion that he had in, by the time he did Search for Spock is, eventually we get back to Voyage Home, Kirk and company are going to return and be assigned to the USS Excelsior. That was the original plan. And in fact, the DC Comics of the 1980s even had Kirk and company warping around the galaxy in the USS Excelsior for two years of comics. And I hope that they don't treat the Enterprise as just a prop.
So. Yeah, the Enterprise should be, I mean, the 2009 movie got it right. There were a lot of very loving shot, even though I don't like that particular design of the Enterprise. There were a lot of moments that were very loving shots. You have the Michael Giacchino score just swelling. The Enterprise, I guess it's rising through the rings of Jupiter, so to speak. So that was a satisfying moment, but I can't say that, you know, and again, props to Beyond for attempting, and it wasn't the most dynamic or beautiful look of it, but they attempted to create to, you know, visually show you the warp bubble, mm-hmm. and give you a kind of a modern day presentation of how, you know, according to Star Trek lore, how that ship would travel. And from, you know, my readings, my amateur research, I'm like, that seems pretty accurate to how they've described it would actually travel. It just doesn't look the most dynamic or exciting on screen.
Right. Well, I mean, I think we've, in many ways, traversed the 13 stories that have made up the movies and those that are connected to it. And, you know, we'll look forward to what happens for the 14th one, whenever that happens. And more importantly, I hope everybody joins us again for our next episode of our podcast here. If you're wanting to keep in touch with us, of course, we have story_trek as our Twitter handle. We also would ask that you like and subscribe to our podcast on whatever platform you're listening to it on.
We thank you for always coming back. We're going to have more episodes in the future. Feel free to reach out to us. Share with us your opinions, your views, your takes. If you think we're wrong, if you think that the Final Frontier is the best of the Star Trek movies overall, then feel free to message us and let us know. Or if you just love Nemesis, feel free to message us and let us know.
All right, so that'll do it for us. I'm Michael Strigakis.
I'm Marshall Hopkins. Live long and prosper.